This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to More Than Amused Podcast, a podcast all about women and the arts, hosted by Stani and Sadie.
Join us as we explore what it's like being a female artist, examine modern day problems, and educate ourselves and you on important and forgotten female artists of the past.
Welcome back to More Than Amused Podcast. My name is Sadie.
I'm Stani, and it's our last week of March Madness.
I know, it's sad. We've been planning and scheming for this month forever because it is, of course, Women's History Month, our podcast. It's our month to shine. Mm-hmm. And so we've been really excited about the content we've had planned. Today's episode has been something that we first referenced years ago.
Oh, yeah. I think it was like our fifth episode, wasn't it?
Yes, actually. Yeah, our fifth episode ever, we talked about the yellow wallpaper. And honestly, it's about time that now, 3 years later, that we are actually talking about it in this way and doing a whole episode on it.
It is about time. We've talked about it so much. I'm glad we actually sat down and read it.
Actually doing it. I know.
And it's so quick. Mine was 20 pages.
Oh, yeah. I found a free version online that was just available for me to download. Yep. That.
I got this cute little book that says The Yellow Wallpaper and Other Stories of Liberation. So it also has a short story from Juna Barnes, who I know you've covered. Yeah, I'm trying to remember which one
it was. Wait, what's the short story? That is so cool.
Okay, I'll tell you what ones it has. It has The Two Offers by Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, The Prescription by Elizabeth Stoddard, which I've heard her name. The Story of an Hour by Kate Chopin. She's come up a lot because of her book, The Lighthouse. Yes. So I'm like, okay. And then The Reckoning by Edith Wharton, Mrs. Spring Fragrance by Sue Sinfar, Miss Fur and Mesquine by Gertrude Stein, What Do You See, Madam by Juna Barnes, Sweat by Zora Neale Hurston, and Sanctuary by Nella Larson.
Okay, this seems like a really great copy. It has all those short stories in it.
I agree. And it also has the artist biographies in the back, which I loved.
Oh, that's so cool.
And it has a great introduction that I skipped, but I'm sure it's beautiful. So
we'll go back and read it later.
Yeah. So that's something to check out. It's The Yellow Wallpaper. I got it on Amazon, and I think it's selected and introduced by Ulrich Baer. So cool. I'm assuming that's who put it all together in this lovely little book.
I love that.
Me too. Oh,
future short stories to do episodes on.
I know, right? I'm like, I'm so excited to look. Before we get into this, though, I had to talk about something I watched today. I'm trying to remember. It was on Hulu. What was the title? The True Story Behind Child Brides.
Oh.
Which, you know, what I wasn't expecting to be an uplifting story. But I put it on while I was finishing some stuff for work. And I don't know why I was like, oh, okay, probably maybe a few cases in the US and then probably more of what's going on outside. No, it was all focused on what's happening in the United States. Ooh. And I didn't realize how – hold on. I'm going to see if I can figure out the whole title. Oh, I Was a Child Bride, The Untold Story. It's from the journalist Elizabeth Vargas, and she interviewed, I think it was like six different women. Guys, horrifying, first off. But I didn't – okay, so I knew that sometimes – people were getting married younger. I'm sure you've heard in most states, if you're under the age of 18, you can get married as long as you have parental consent, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's what we've been told. What I was not aware of is that when you go to do that, first off, it doesn't seem like anyone in the court asks any questions. Not once did they turn to the girl and go, do you actually want to get married to this man who is double your age?
Oh, yeah. That's – yeah. Whoa. That's – yeah. Great
also,
point.
There's no minimum. So technically, like a one-year-old child could get married as long as their parent consents. There's no law against it. So because they're not like saying like 18 is the minimum, they didn't set a minimum either. So one of the people actually got married at 10 years old to a guy who was 25.
Oh, no. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So that's something also that shocked me a lot. Another thing is they brought up the fact that, okay, so if you have sex or rape a younger person when you're an adult, it's considered statutory rape in pretty much every state, right?
Yes, absolutely.
However, if you marry them,
oh, no.
It's completely legal. All of these women, every single one of the stories they brought up, had a baby before they were 18 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, by the hands of their abuser, who I think in the majority of the cases, they were double their age. Like one of the girls, she was 15 and he was 30. It was always like a huge age gap. Like it's not a 17-year-old and a 17-year-old getting married. It's
or even
an adult
like,
marrying a child.
This isn't right, but like a 19 and 17-year-old.
Yeah. Like even that would make more sense. Yeah.
Like maybe they met in high school. I don't know.
Exactly. So it's not – those aren't the cases most of the time. And they brought up the fact that there's – I'm trying to remember the exact number. I know it was like over 60,000 marriages in like the last year or something were like child – bride. And I'm probably getting that a little warped, but it was something crazy like that. Like it was a child marriage.
Well, like just a lot more than you would think.
Oh,
because
yeah.
You wouldn't think that's really actually happening that often.
Yes. And then they also brought up the fact that like the US government wrote this letter about how they're condemning child marriages in other countries, but then they turn around and they won't outlaw it in our own.
It's interesting how this seems to be a theme of the month.
Yeah.
Just this idea of how easy it is to point fingers at other places in the world without being willing to take a step back and realize what's actually happening in your own home,
yeah,
in your own communities, and looking to see what could be done. That is just something that keeps popping up this month. And I just find that very important and interesting.
And what made it so much worse is that when you're under the age of 18, you cannot hire an attorney, which means you can't file for a divorce. You can't get custody of your children, even though you've had them. Like the girl who got married at 10, she was pregnant at 9 years old. She was pregnant every single year. By the time she was like 17, she had 6 kids that she had raised on her own, and she couldn't file for custody.
Whoa. Okay. Thank you for this recommendation.
I'm going to go watch it. And one more thing. They can't get into a domestic violence shelter if they're under the age of 18 either. So one of them was being abused, and they're not allowed to admit you into a domestic violence shelter if you're under 18 because it's a liability. So there's like all these things where it's like, oh, this is so messed up. And then they like took it to the government to try to pass some laws. And all of the people were like, my parents got married when they were 17. And who are we to tell people what they can and can't do? And like a guy can enlist for the military at 17. And then the people were there saying, this isn't what it's being used for.
Like, you're right. Like, sure. But also like a lot of times with those people, it's can't they just wait one more year to
get
married? Exactly.
That's what I thought. And then one of them brought up the fact, he was like, isn't it better for unwed pregnant women to be married than not? And the lady who was there, who had all of the statistics and everything, like she wants to pass legislation in all 50 states against it. Mm-hmm. She said it is statistically better for women to remain single if they're younger than 18 and pregnant.
Yeah.
Because they will remain in poverty. They are more likely to get beaten. They are more likely to have, they literally said heart disease, cancer, like all of this is more likely because of the stress that you're putting them under at such a young age. And so it's not better. I'm sorry. If 2 17-year-olds get pregnant, it's not better for them to get married.
It's not better.
No.
I'm sorry. Like they can still have a great life. Like they're not damned, of course, but it's not objectively better for them.
No, especially the 10-year-old girl. Like this guy, he was like, he was the priest or something of her church. And when the bishop or pastor, whatever it's called, found out, he said, okay, you have to get married. And so they went to the county house or whatever, and the guy there said, no way, I will not marry them, thank heavens. But then they just drove a county over and did it there.
Hey.
Yeah. So I'm like, gosh, there are so many things wrong with that. So it's horrifying, but like it, I don't know, like it helped me understand more of what's going on in that whole situation. And I feel like it is like a further push for like better sex education, like stricter laws for sexual assault, but like stuff like that I think would help protect people, because apparently none of our lawmakers are willing to pass a law that means that people can only get married once they're 18.
Or at least, like you said, have a minimum. Like,
right.
I don't know. I mean, none of it's good, though. So. No.
Someone was like, I guess we could pass the thing where if they get married before they're 18, then they'll be legally emancipated. And it's great. So they have to go through getting married and all of that in order to get away from their parents who are forcing them into marriage so that they can finally get a divorce.
Yeah, interesting.
It's like you're going to force them into an abusive situation in order to flee one?
True.
Good yeah, point. I don't know. It's bad. So anyway, if you want to get mad.
It is the theme of the month of here's a bunch of stuff that you could get mad about if you want to.
Yeah, it definitely tied into like our first episodes of the month. So I wanted to bring it up. But
no,
also,
you.
I'm just like, ugh.
Thank you for bringing that up. What a horrific thing to know about. But feels important. So
I know, right?
Feels important. Whew. Should we talk then about the yellow wallpaper?
Yes.
Which is very different, of course, but very, it's so consistent with a lot of our theme. We talked about it when we talked about the gothic horror writers of the 20th century? 19th century. You're right. Duh. And we talked about hysteria last year, and we talked, that kind of ties into that of like female hysteria and women and mental health and how that's been perceived and changed. Talked about it on Friday's episode with the bell jar a little bit. But you said you have like her bio and an essay about why she wrote it in that book. I want to hear that.
I do. Okay. Charlotte Perkins Gilman is the one who wrote it. And she was born in 1860 and then died in 1935. She was an American novelist and short story writer born in Hartford, Connecticut. And of course, she's best known for The Yellow Wallpaper.
It's
her most famous work, which was first published in the New England Magazine. And we'll talk more about what it is later, but it's like some diary entries from a woman while she's locked up in her house by her physician husband, who says that he's doing it for like her treatment.
Yes.
To help with a nervous breakdown. Like that's his justification for it. Of course, she like wrote it because it was her protest against the social oppression of women and the treatment of women by a largely male medical profession, which we talked about a lot in our previous episodes that we've mentioned. And it's because that's what she had been prescribed herself, which I'll bring up in her essay when I read that. And then after she got a different diagnosis from one of the first female doctors and a suffragist named Mary Putman Jacobi, who prescribed her a regimen of mental and physical activity, which was more effective, and she recovered.
Yeah, I remember reading about that too. It's, wow, who would have thought that doing the opposite of wallowing in your, you know, there's double fold. Sometimes your body does need to rest. Sometimes you do need to recover, but actually, like...
Everything we know about modern mental health says, do not lay in your bed and sleep all day.
Yeah, that's not good. Don't... Yeah, and it's they're very much encouraging it. Like, solitude is not the answer.
No.
Hardly ever. No.
Especially in a room with disgusting wallpaper. So...
Valid.
So then over the course of her life, she was able to become a prominent women's rights activist and eventually a successful lecturer, earning her living through speaking engagements throughout the United States. Her lectures were reported in newspapers and other publications, including the New York Times, the Boston Post, the San Francisco Examiner, and the Women's Journal. After relocating to San Francisco in 1894, she served as an editor for a weekly publication of the Pacific Coast Women's Press Association. In 1898, she published a widely discussed manifesto titled Women and Economics, in which she called for restoring women to economic independence, amen, which would result in clarifying and harmonizing the human soul. And she also has been inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame, which I have not heard of before.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what other women are in the National Hall of Fame.
Yes, I agree. Okay, can I read her essay?
Please do it.
It's so funny. Okay, so it's why I wrote The Yellow Wallpaper. So it says, many and many a reader has asked that. When the story first came out in the New England Magazine about 1891, a Boston physician made a protest in the Transcript. Such a story ought not to be written, he said. It was enough to drive anyone mad to read it.
I don't think so.
Another physician in Kansas, I think, wrote to say that it was the best description of incipient insanity he had ever seen and begging my pardon had I been there. Now, the story of the story is this. For many years, I suffered from a severe and continuous nervous breakdown tending to melancholia and beyond. During about the third year of this trouble, I went, in devout faith and some faint stir of hope, to a noted specialist in nervous diseases, the best known in the country. This wise man put me to bed and applied the rest cure, to which a still good physique responded so promptly that he concluded that there was nothing much the matter with me, and sent me home with solemn advice to live as domestic a life as far as possible.
Oh.
To have but 2 hours intellectual life a day, and to never touch pen, brush, or pencil again as long as I lived. She's an author.
Yeah.
But he's also like, no hobbies.
Just get lost in domestic pursuits.
Yep. Whoa. This was in 1887. Mm-hmm. I went home and obeyed those directions for some 3 months and came so near to the borderline of utter mental ruin that I could see over.
Yeah.
Then, using the remnants of intelligence that remained and helped by a wise friend, I cast the noted specialist advice to the winds and went to work again. Work, the normal life of every human being. Work, in which is joy and growth and service, without which one is pauper and parasite, ultimately recovering some measure of power. Being naturally moved to rejoicing by this narrow escape, I wrote the yellow wallpaper with its embellishments and additions to carry out the ideal. I never had hallucinations or objections to my mural decorations.
Oh my God.
And she sent a copy to the physician who so nearly drove me mad. He never acknowledged it. The little book is valued by alienists as a good specimen of one kind of literature. It has, to my knowledge, saved one woman from a similar fate, so terrifying her family that they let her out into normal activity and she recovered. But the best result is this. Many years later, I was told that the great specialist had admitted to friends of his that he had altered his treatment of neurasthenia since reading the yellow wallpaper. It was not intended to drive people crazy, but to save people from being driven crazy, and it worked.
Slow clap.
Like, isn't that the best?
That's incredible.
And that's why I had to read it. It made me so happy. I was like, not only did she send it to him, he fixed it.
He's
and
like,
then,
oh.
Yeah. And it is a horrifying tale, because the sad part is that was like the natural remedy for women who were suffering with depression during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And people would read it and then be like, oh my gosh, she's going to be driven nuts. Go crazy. Let her go outside.
This is not the answer. Oh my gosh. I am so glad you have that and found it. Because I did look up some information about, of course, it. And I did read that she sent it to him.
Mm-mm.
But to hear it in her own words like that, that's amazing.
I know. I was so thrilled. And it makes the story so much more enjoyable, because it's like, oh yeah, like you can tell she went through this. Like the physician who's, that's the most accurate description of this I've ever read. Have you endured it?
I just like the incredible audacity to just send it off. Good for her. Good for her. And the story's, honestly, it's a great story, of course, but it's horrifying. And you know what? I'm just glad that it does mirror a true story and it's based on true events. But thankfully, this actual ending was much happier than the descent to madness that this woman goes
through. Do you want to give us like an overview of the story?
Yeah, I would love to. So basically, the story is written as a collection of journal entries that's narrated in the first person, which is this woman who has been suffering from a nervous breakdown in some way or another. And she has a physician husband who has rented an old mansion for the summer, intended to be a place for her to go get better. There's other rooms in the house, but the husband confines her to an upstairs nursery. Like, she talks about that a lot, how it's something that used to be used for children, which is very infantilizing. And I think it's very important imagery there and symbolism.
Yeah.
But as a form of treatment, the husband forbids the journal writer from working or from writing. So she talks about how she has to like write when he's not there or the sister isn't there, but encourages her to eat well and get plenty of air so that she can recuperate. As you keep reading, she becomes more and more fascinated on this really ugly yellow wallpaper that's up in the nursery, because she doesn't really have anything better to do. And so she creates inventing things with it. Something to note is that this happens after the birth of a child.
Yes, which I thought that was really important.
In that reference point, like, postpartum depression, we know, is a really common thing. And so I thought that was such an interesting thing. I wrote down a couple quotes where one thing she said, "It is fortunate Mary is so good with the baby, such a dear baby, and yet I cannot be with him. It makes me so nervous."
And she never names the baby. you can tell there's that it's so many symptoms of postpartum depression.
Absolutely.
Which is really sad.
But as the story, she focuses more and more on the fact that this wallpaper, how it's a gross color, it has a yellow smell, it has weird patterns on that. And she also, I think, falls deeper into the fact that she's only in one room. Mm-hmm. The wallpaper kind of begins to mutate and it just becomes more intriguing to her. She starts seeing like figures in the design, and then she comes to believe that a woman is like creeping in the wallpaper, and she like feels like she has to free the woman. So she begins to strip and tear down the paper. But also at the same time, like, summer's coming to an end and she knows that they're going to be moving out soon. At a certain point, her husband arrives home and she's locked the door and threw the key out. He's opened the door and she's, ha, I can't. The key is out there. And then when he returns, he finds her just obviously gone mad, rubbing against the wallpaper, tearing it down.
I think crawling on all fours or something.
Crawling on all fours. One quote is, I've got out at last in spite of you. He faints and she was like, huh, why'd he do that? It's the attitude I got.
Yeah.
And she just keeps on circling, believing herself to have become the woman that is trapped inside the yellow wallpaper. In the end, just fully losing her mind, and which is the whole point, is she's like, okay, cool, you leave a woman alone. Like, this is actually what happens. There's a couple quotes that I copied over that I mm-hmm. really liked. From the beginning of the story, when she's just really just giving the bare information on their dynamic, she says, John laughs at me, of course, but one expects that in marriage, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. John is practical in the extreme. He has no patience with faith, an intense horror of superstition, and he scoffs openly at any talk of things not to be felt and seen and put down in figures. There's a lot of moments in this too where she does have ideas of, can't I go visit people? Can't I please go outside? And he almost says, oh, no, you silly girl. And there's a lot of infantilizing language of treating her like, no, like almost like little one. I can't remember the exact words that
yeah,
is used.
He calls her like a little like girl pretty often.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of
babying. Other quotes is, I cry at nothing and cry most of the time. Of course, I don't know. I don't when John is here or anybody else, but when I am alone. And again, and I know John would think it's absurd, but I must say, I feel and think in some ways it is such a relief. Again, just so much stories of, she's aware that the people around her think that she's crazy, but is also, no, but I do know I'm feeling this way.
Yeah.
And that's just like over and over again in the quotes. I can almost just read you the whole story, because the whole story is like these little tidbits of her being so aware of the fact that John thinks that she is crazy, but, and also like knowing that she's crazy, but then also being like, I don't think this is helping me, but I guess this is going to help me. Kind of like, you can see her struggling within herself of like, I don't feel like writing, and they tell me that I shouldn't be writing, but I am writing right now because it's just because I have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's frustrating. Did you remember, I'm trying to find it, the quote where she says that it's almost like John is keeping me sick?
Yes.
I was trying to find it, but I don't know. She has affection, whether or not it's like the confinement or something, where she, maybe he prefers me this way.
Yeah.
Where it's just so better for him.
Feels like everyone's in on it. Yeah.
Because they won't let her write. They're keeping her in the room. Like mm-hmm. all of the stuff where she's hiding everything from everyone. And even the fact that he wouldn't let her take down the wallpaper. First mm-hmm. she was like, can I be in the bigger room, like the adult room downstairs that's nice and mm-hmm. has like a window with the stained glass on everything. And he's, oh no, there's not enough room. We have to go to the nursery.
Yes, exactly. And also there's bars on the nursery windows, and she makes a lot of justifications at first of just being like, oh, these bars must have been here because the kids were crazy. And that's why there's all these locks and the guard on the mm-hmm. stairs and everything, when like maybe John put those there.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is the full quote at the end, which is, I've got out at last, said I, in spite of you and Jane, and I've pulled off most of the paper so you can't put me back. So like this idea of,
you can't trap me in here again.
You can't trap me again anymore. Or even just this one where it's, so I take phosphates or phosphites, whichever it is, and tonics and journeys and air and exercise, and I'm absolutely forbidden to work until I am well again. Personally, I disagree with their ideas.
Yes.
So just so much of, no, but I guess he's a doctor, but I don't think this is working.
Yeah. And pardon me for a minute, I was like, was there mold on this wallpaper? And she's like, being driven insane by it. Because the way she describes
she talks about how it's nasty.
And then she even says that she catches John and Jane looking at it sometimes, like as if they can almost see it. And she gets paranoid by, are they seeing it too? But they won't say anything.
Oh, good point.
Oh, here it is. The fact is, I'm getting a little afraid of John. He seems very queer sometimes, and even Jenny has an inexplicable look. It strikes me occasionally just a scientific hypothesis that perhaps it is the paper. I have watched John when he did not know I was looking and come into the room suddenly on the most innocent excuses, and I've caught him several times looking at the paper. And Jenny, too. I caught Jenny with her hand on it once. And she says that the reason why is because she said that it had this awful dust on it and it would get on all of her and John's clothes. And I was like, why didn't they rip out this paper? It sounds disgusting.
It sounds nasty.
Yeah. And he literally says that he won't do it because she's making such a big deal out of it that she would turn to something else. Remember? It was such a horrible excuse.
Yeah. Or it was almost like the idea of, oh, this is giving into your depression.
Yes.
In a way, which is, no, giving into the profession depression is sitting in the room all day with nothing to do.
But stare at the wallpaper. It's such a sad story, but in so many ways it's so funny too, because at the end you're just like, or she's even now, why should that man have fainted? But he did, and right across my path by the wall, so that I had to creep over him every time.
Yep.
Like, oh, and he got in my way.
Right. Like, why did that idiot fall over? Yeah. Like,
what once again, do? Just impeding what I'm trying to do.
So valid. Honestly, this story's funny because now we know that it created a real life happy ending. So it's hilarious. And really, just what an important work in just feminist literature, and just not even feminism, but like just women literature, period. Mm-hmm. And just the plight of women and mental health and how they have been treated for centuries. It's like, it feels like maybe now it's, oh, we're finally making progress. But I feel like that's just even in the last 5 to 10 years, even in just how much since we've graduated high school, the way people talk about it, it's changed so much. Even just like from me as a high schooler being depressed and not having the verbiage for it to then now, I feel like people are so much more willing to talk about it. It's so interesting how this is where we've started, you know, reading this is, oh, we did come a long way, but I think we do still have a long way to go as far as
definitely
women's health and how we care for them.
It's funny too, we read this and this is in the 19th century. Like, she was born in the 1800s. And then you think of the feminine mystique and how that talks about mental health for women in the 50s and 60s and how once again, leaving women at home all alone with no purpose doesn't really make you feel super happy.
Yeah,
truly. And so they would just give them a bunch of... Oh, what were they called? The pills like that pills? Just zone you out. I don't remember. But basically just super strength.
Tranquilizers.
Knock you out. Yes, literally. And so they're like, here you go. This is the cure.
This will make you feel better.
Mm-hmm. And like, how many times is it just, okay, when are we get to the point where you're like, maybe domestic bliss isn't the solution.
Isn't actually, go do more domestic labors. You'll feel better. Like, I don't know about that one. I do believe that motherhood is a source of joy, and I don't have any children, so I can't speak from experience, but like, I believe there's joy there. But I also do very strongly believe you can't get lost and have that become your only pillar of identity, because you will be driven into madness. And maybe people listening don't agree with me there, but I've read a lot of stories at this point that tell me otherwise.
Yeah, and not just stories, like studies and facts and everything. You cannot base your entire existence around someone else. Even if it's your child, even if it's your husband, it's not healthy. You can't do that. You've got to have something else, even if it's a hobby. Literally, and if it's jogging, that could save you so much. Baking, anything that you can do to give yourself more independence and self-sufficiency and more of an identity outside of just
domestic duties.
Yes, that helps so much more than I think people realize. That's why so many women end up getting into side hustles or something at home, because literally, guys, it's just unnecessary. Yeah.
Don't go crazy, please.
Yes.
No, I think that me and you, we've talked a lot about the feminine mystique. That's another one. It's a long time coming for an episode on the podcast, but we both want to reread it, but also like want to be able to reread it properly. And it's a bigger book than this, but I think some people look at a book like that or even these ideas and they're like, oh, that's very 1960s. That's not happening now. But I think me and you talked a lot about how how the reason why the feminine mystique was so important to us was because there was so many things that we witnessed growing up in our own community that still felt so relevant.
Yeah.
And which is, it's crazy because that book was written at this point. Whoa, this, yeah, like 80 years ago is the 60s, which is crazy.
And you look at it and, well, we did grow up in a really religious community that still pretty traditional values where, for the most part, I think from a very young age, when people would ask girls what they wanted to be when they grew up, I think the majority of my peers said mom.
And of course, like, no, I'm not like meaning to shame people who do want to grow up and be a mom. And even if that's like the main thing in life that you're excited for, but there's a difference between when you ask boys and it's, if they were to say, oh, I want to be a dad, you'd be like, no, but what do you really want to be?
Yeah.
Kind of a thing. And I really do think that language is very important. Mm-hmm. And it really affects, I don't know, how people think about themselves, even just, I don't know, it opens up a world of potential possibilities in your brain where you can actually imagine yourself doing things. And if men can have lives outside and also have families, I do believe women can too.
I do
and
too.
Obviously, I believe that. I'm saying things that are like very obvious things with like qualifiers. Yeah. And I don't mean to do that. I just I'm generally working on not putting on qualifiers before every opinion that I have. but still, it's just, I think it is still relevant today. And that's why we have this podcast. That's why we're doing this every week, is because it feels relevant for people to be thinking about these things and know that these are ideas and problems that women have had for centuries.
Mm-hmm. And continue to have.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, as good as it's getting. And I really am so grateful that it's getting better. Mm-hmm. Like even this year with women in sports, like watching that happen has been incredible because that's been such a male-dominated space for so long. And like last year with women in entertainment and Taylor Swift and Barbie and everything, like we're making
even
a lot
like
of progress.
Even like the Me Too movement within the last couple years.
Yeah. So it's like there's so many good things happening. But I think like it comes down to it that I feel like each woman individually has to have her own personal feminist awakening, or else like the world's not really gonna change that much. And I think that's like the most important thing that can happen too, is like you realizing, oh, I'm an individual, I deserve rights. And that seems so ridiculous to say, but like I know we've both had that moment where we're like, oh yeah,
can I okay. Maybe I'll take this part out of the podcast. We can decide after I say what I'm about to say. But I was messaging my best friend from home. I won't put names in here in case anyone, she would not have a problem with me shouting her out. She's not on the podcast. So anyways, we were texting last night and she shared with me like, oh, it was a guy that we went to high school with, married someone who is doing a sex ed type thing, like almost like a class on taking away the shame behind sex. And I was like, wow, first off, that's so cool. Two, why is it that like every woman that like either every woman that we went to high school with or every like woman I hear of that married a guy that I went to high school with, I'm like, they are so cool. Like they are doing the coolest things. And we were like joking of it's because like we had to deal with so much at our high school from all the men and boys around us that we all had to have some like massive awakening to do something and be like, no, that was not good, not right. And anyways, I don't really know what the point is I was making with that of more of it was just really funny, but it is fun to see people that you grew up with do really cool things. So go women. There's my soapbox.
Yeah, I think it's just something important to remember. And I do hope for one day a generation where I don't have daughters that have to go through like a feminist awakening. I hope it's just something that they grow up knowing. I don't know why I'm getting teary. I just want that where they know from the very beginning, I have rights. I exist beyond my identity as just a woman. Like,
and also I don't have to let people treat me this way.
Yeah.
I think that's like also another thing where I think growing up, I felt so much of I have to be quiet. I have to make sure I'm like maintaining that like everyone around me is comfortable and okay. And I just let a lot of people get away with things.
Yeah.
That, like now, if someone were to even like hint at doing something, I'd be like, absolutely not.
I know, right?
But the amount of things you let slide, I think, before you're like, oh, I don't have to do that. Like that's, it's just, it's crazy.
It's insane to me that has to be a thing. Mm-hmm. I don't hear a lot of guys talking about that. They're like, oh, the moment I decided, oh yeah, I have to advocate for myself.
Yeah.
And that's like nothing against my parents, because I honestly think they were extremely equitable and great. I think it's just, it's the nature of our world.
Yeah, I was going to say we are environments of our culture and the world, and there's so many things that can send us messages, even if we are getting messages that are right along the way.
Did you see the congressman who was talking to the pilot from Delta? And he's like, no. So what's your job? And she goes, I'm a Delta pilot. And he goes, oh, so can you tell me the day to day of what your life is like as a stewardess?
Oh, I did see that.
I'm a pilot for Delta. And he goes, oh, sorry, as a pilot. And it's, what the heck? Like, women can fly planes, believe it or not.
Also, perhaps a talk of age limits on Congress. I don't know.
Yeah, if you can't listen attentively, like, maybe you shouldn't be there. Plus, maybe when did we use stewardess? Old. Isn't that really
ancient term? That's kind of what I'm saying. I'm like, not even flight attendant?
I don't know about that.
Gosh. A little too old for that job, I think.
Yeah.
Sorry, not to be ageist, obviously. Sorry. But
I'm just congressist.
Yeah. I'm just irritated with what I'm seeing.
Yeah. But no, it's just implicit bias and things like that, where like you think of pilot and everyone immediately thinks tall white man. And,
tall man.
Mm-hmm,
tall
yeah. Man, and it's like, how can we change that so that like our daughters, our granddaughters don't have to grow up in a world that's like, that's already fighting against them so much.
Wow. Yeah. This is the most empowered recording and episode I have been this whole month. It's about time. It's Women's History Month. We should be feeling empowered.
I agree. And I wish we would have read this short story in school instead of the creepy one about the guy who hunted people.
I don't remember that one.
Oh my gosh. Wait, I think I brought it up before and you didn't read it.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. It's horrifying, Sadie. You really should read it.
What is it called?
Well, I think it's called The Hunt.
Oh, joy. Okay, hold on. I'm Googling it.
Hey. Oh, The Most Dangerous Game.
Oh.
Yep. This guy swims to an island off of the Caribbean coast and he meets this rich guy and then he like lets him out into the jungle and is, I'm going to hunt you. He was actually trying to call out like big game hunting in Africa and how like rich people go and kill elephants and stuff. So he did it in like this. I understand what the guy was going for, but I don't think big game hunting is like applicable to our life now as mental illness. So I think I would have preferred to read the yellow wallpaper rather than having reoccurring moments where I think about in my life, oh yeah, remember that guy who hunted down the guy in Africa in that short story I read in eighth grade?
Really valid, actually. Incredible. All right. Thank you for joining us. This is a shorter episode today. We're going to be back on Friday with more talk about women's history. Also, it's the last week that our More Than a Muse March Madness merch is going to be available and for sale. So if you're interested in joining it, get it while it's hot and available for the rest of the week.
MoreThanAmusePodcast.com.
I know. We are going to be doing merch again, but we are going to be doing like these limited merch drops where it's like for March, certain designs. And then we already have a design figured out for July and then potentially another one in October for our anniversary. Mm-hmm. So just know that there will be merch again, but I don't necessarily know when this March Madness merch will come back. So
yeah. And maybe it won't. We'll see.
Maybe it won't. Yeah. So grab it if you want it.
Yep.
Because it's not available forever.
Yep. And definitely come back on Friday for our last episode of the month. I can't believe it's over. Oh, also one more thing I did want to shout out.
Yes.
There is a company who made a short film of, actually it's like a full length film, of the yellow wallpaper, which I'm going to watch. It's actually by Hysteria Pictures, which love. And you can watch it for free with ads on Fandango at home. I think I'll post the link in the description. It is rated mature, obviously.
Because of the themes.
Yeah. And it's an hour and 40 minutes, but I think they premiered it at like a film festival and it came out in 2022. So like fairly recently, but it like looks really cool. There's like a shadow behind a woman walking with the yellow wallpaper and everything. So definitely something to check out if you want like a film.
I love aspect that idea. Of
it. That's probably horrifying. So excited to watch it.
Amazing. Yeah. Perfect. We will be back on Friday.
See you soon. Bye. Bye.